This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Schon mal eine Ferienunterkunft gebucht, die der reinste Horror war?
Das sieht gar nicht aus wie auf den Fotos.
Ah, ist eine Tür hinter all den Spinnen?
Dann probier eine App, mit der ein Happy End gewiss ist.
Ah, perfekt.
Alles gut, du hast bei Fevo direkt gebucht.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Dolan Show!
COVID-19 inquiry comes to Belfast today. It started up this morning, and my goodness on air, guttural, raw pain from people still affected by the decisions of the government. There is no suggestion from me that those decisions were right or wrong. That's for the inquiry to determine. But there are real people in the very heart of this country that still need answers. That's all coming up on the programme.
The Stephen Dolan Show!
Good morning. It's not just about the food for people in Northern Ireland, or indeed the food that we supply to people outside this country. It's about the reputation of Northern Ireland to be a place where our livestock are safe, our food supply can be relied upon, our businesses, that huge sector, that huge industry that is here in Northern Ireland that creates so many jobs is being protected. And that is why when this committee at Westminster has expressed concern about the production and supply of veterinary medicines here, that people need to take notice about what is going on. Lord Jay, you'll hear later in the programme this morning, concerned that if a deal is not done between the British government and the European Union, it could have a devastating impact on our industry here. The DUP MP Ian Paisley also has been taking an interest in this. Can you imagine a scenario where a deal isn't done? What would that do to Northern Ireland, Ian?
Well, good morning, Stephen. Well, I think if a deal isn't done, it will be disastrous. I think it's important, and you've done it there in your introduction, I think it's important to put this in context. Northern Ireland, whilst it has a whole lot of other industries going on, which are very, very important and very significant, and they're wonderful to have, our primary industry is the production of food. Safe, traceable, tasty food. And a lot of us just take it for granted. But Northern Ireland produces most of its food, not just for the people of Northern Ireland, but for people across GB, our principal market. And that means that, for example, 80% of all eggs hatched in Northern Ireland go to GB. You've got all sorts of foods like that going on, and protecting those foods and showing that they're quality assured and that we can stand over their quality and their traceability is absolutely key. Now, if you then turn around and say, well, by the way, between 30 and 50% of the vaccines and other medicines that you use to keep animals healthy and to make sure that animal welfare, remember, you only make good, tasty, traceable food if you've got great animal husbandry and that you look after your animals well. And if those vaccines or those medicines are no longer available or are reduced or become problematic,
because the grace period ends at the end of next year, the grace period because of Brexit, because of the Windsor Framework.
Well, if those medicines come to an end, or there's a restriction on them, or there's a problem in delivering them, that then impacts on that food chain. And the impact there, as your reporter in the news bulletin, Louise Cullen, said, that impacts something very important called food security. And that impacts people's confidence, and that would have a devastating impact. Say, for example, GB were to say to us, we can't take 80% of the eggs which Northern Ireland hatches because there's a risk of salmonella. That would devastate our egg trade. That would devastate our poultry trade. Say if then they were to say, there's now an impact and we're not sure if your other beasts are properly vaccinated. That would impact our ability to trade. Now, we also are a very, very significant trader with the rest of the world. I'll give you an example. Pork products made in Northern Ireland, the only country in the UK, the only part of the UK that is able to export its pig meat to China is Northern Ireland. It's a massive market. So if that were to be impacted, that would destroy our pig trade. So there's all sorts of things that are at play here, and that's why we don't have 18 months. The grace period, yes, is coming to an end, but pharmaceutical companies, people who are taking the decisions in office, are taking the decisions in the next 3 to 6 months. And we need this solved immediately. This is a major problem that's got to be addressed to save our food industry and to make sure that the quality of the food we have. And can I just say one other thing, because it's quite important. This isn't an argument about what is in the medicine bottles. So, for example, the vaccines that we're going to use are the exact same vaccines that are used in the EU. This is a question about labelling on the bottles. And you'll say, that's ridiculous, Ian. But that is exactly what we're down to. We're arguing about the source of the label and where those medicines have been verified. And that issue is, for a lot of people, so obscure, but yet the impact on food production and food security could be mammoth. So we've got to address, I'm glad there's a committee working on this. I'm one of the members of that committee. There's a number of other party representatives from across the piece working on this to try and solve. We've got experts from the Ulster Farmers Union, from the British Veterinary Association, from all sorts of other organisations, public and private, trying to make sure that before the summer, this matter is solved.
It begs the obvious question, that if the impact in Northern Ireland could be so devastating, if it is so important to get this done, why on earth did your party go back into government and do the deal and tell everybody an REC border didn't exist when it clearly does? Why'd you go back in before sorting this?
Well, you know, we've been trying to sort this one out since October of 2019. This has been flagged up way back then. And the issue of trying to get it resolved is absolutely key. I want it resolved. And
but
yes,
why didn't you insist on it being resolved before going back in the government?
I know you're away for a few weeks, but I made it clear what my position was during that period, and I lost that vote within my party. But the issue is I've got to deal with how the ball lands now. And the ball has landed in a particular way, and we've got to play it. We've got to make sure that we're successful. There is no... If we lose this one, the impact on the Northern Ireland economy is massive. And I'm glad to say that there appears to be a united front from the experts and the politicians across the piece in Northern Ireland and the UK to have this solved. And if we can use that collective will, then hopefully we can get it solved and avoid this crisis. And then we can haggle over and pick over the bones who said what, where and when. But I'm interested in solutions and getting solutions to problems. And we have a commitment that we're going to try and do that.
When you say, Ian, if we lose this one, is there a chance we could lose this one?
Well, if, for example, the EU is obstinate and says, that deal's done, we're not going back on it, we're not changing at all. And the impact then is, you know, will the government be prepared to then legislate separately for this? Would the knockout impact there then affect cross-border trade? Because we do considerable amount of cross-border trade with regards to foods as well. But I think this is one of these ones which the EU, and remember we're about to get a new commission, there's European elections ongoing at the present time. I think the EU knows that this is one of these messy ones for them. Look how, for example, this immigration thing has affected the Republic of Ireland. This affects everyone. You know, we don't just operate in a little silo here. What impacts Northern Ireland will ultimately impact on the EU. And I think there'll be a waking up and smelling of the coffee that if they don't solve this and help Northern Ireland solve this and fix this one, then the impact for the EU will also be there. So,
but why haven't they sorted it by now? I'm trying to understand.
Yes.
You say that this has been discussed for years now. Why has it not been sorted so far?
Well, the solution was obvious at the time. That was, of course, to treat veterinary medicines in the same way as we treated human medicines and to have resolved it at that point and to have fixed it at that point. It wasn't. Did someone fail to do that or was it just too complex to get done? Again, those are matters which we could argue and debate. The fact of the matter is this is the problem. This needs to be solved. The focus is on it. And the timeline to get it fixed, as I say, is within months, not 18 months, because the grace period, by the time December 2025 comes, the veterinary companies, the veterinary industry, I should say, and the pharmaceutical companies will have already had to take their business and make their decisions elsewhere and go in a different direction. And that's not good enough. Therefore, we have to do this now.
And Ian, finally, the story that we're turning to now, the COVID inquiry begins in Belfast today. I see the police presence outside the Clayton Hotel and I was driving into work. Are you confident that that inquiry will get the answers to some of the questions that remain in Northern Ireland from those people who are just wondering about the government messages which were wiped, which are wondering about lockdown, who are thinking about how they couldn't go to the funerals of their loved ones when our now First Minister attended the funeral of Bobby Storey, the comments from Edwin Poots. Do you think the answers will actually be got?
Well, my first thoughts on this, and my thoughts and prayers with the victims, I've met the Northern Ireland Victims Group. They're a really fantastic group of people who are dedicated to getting to the truth, and my thoughts and prayers are primarily with them, because you know their search for the truth is going to be a long and painful journey. I do believe there should be a separate Northern Ireland inquiry. It's always been my position, because I think dipping in and out of this Northern Ireland piece will not necessarily get us that level of detail that you're already asking about. But I think the exposure of the hypocrisy around how this all happened will come out, and I think people will in the future be very, very sceptical about a government that says they can mass take these decisions that affect the mass public in one go. I think there's been a lot of scepticism created about government decisions in this issue when it comes to health.
What's the biggest question you have in your head around the dealing of COVID-19?
Well, I tell you what a constituent came to me about the time. A constituent and a family came to me and said, look, we're trying to conceive and we want to have a child. And the advice initially was the vaccine's safe. And then the vaccine, well, then there was other advice put out and said, well, the vaccine isn't safe if you're pregnant or trying to get pregnant. And then they changed it again. In the space of 18 months, three separate pieces of advice. And nurses, doctors...
Well, they were learning about a new virus, weren't they?
Yes. Yeah, but they were left completely, spinning about what they should do. And the anxiety in young families trying to create a family, that causes complete and total anxiety. And that's just one tiny element of it. And I think that needs to be, that's what I picked up whenever for my constituents at the time, because it was quite traumatic for some of them. And then, of course, we had the issues around about, funerals and people's visitation rights at nursing homes and all of that, and not being able to, was their loved ones properly nursed in their last few hours? I mean, all of that has exposed a huge anxiety within people, and people left with huge doubts and huge thoughts about how was my loved one treated in the last few hours. And I don't think people will ever get over that, and I hope there will be lessons learned, because this must be not just about looking back and identifying all these issues, but about looking forward and saying, this cannot ever be allowed to happen again.
Ian Paisley, thank you very much. That's the DUP MP Ian Paisley this morning. Our health correspondent Mary-Louise Connolly with us today. So tell us about this inquiry which begins today, Mary-Louise.
Yes, morning, Stephen. I'm just across the road from you in the Clayton Hotel. It really is a hive of activity. The COVID UK inquiry team has arrived in Belfast. It has taken over a great deal of this hotel. So what you have seen so far in London, where those big names, including the former Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, Nicola Sturgeon, all those big names that give evidence, well, this has now been transferred to Belfast. And sitting here in the lobby are the families, those who really are at the heart of this story, sitting with their legal teams discussing about what is just going to happen within the next hour. Let me bring you just one of those stories. Sean Scullion, he's here with his sisters. He lost his mum, Nuala Scullion, in 2021. He told me that she walked out of the house on a very cold morning in January, walked into an ambulance, was well, said goodbye to them, said she would see them shortly, but they never saw their mum again. Due to visitation rights, they weren't allowed into the hospital. And actually, 4 weeks later, they said goodbye to her via a Zoom call, via an iPad that staff held at her hospital bed, on her deathbed. and they said goodbye to her before the machine was turned off. Now, Sean said that's just not good enough. He said they are carrying that guilt around with them. They want answers as to what information, why decision makers within the health service, within government departments, the civil service, what they based their decision making on, that families like Sean Scullion and his sisters weren't able to go into their hospital to see their mum to say goodbye. And just as we were talking here, Stephen, the families of the brave families, they're just gathering outside the hotel. They're wearing red T-shirts with the words "for those loved and lost." And they're here to make presents. This is their day.
My Louise, the decision makers themselves, they didn't have the benefit of hindsight when they were making those decisions. Do we expect a robust defence from them? And who's going to be doing that on their behalf? Will it be them appearing at the inquiry doing that themselves?
Each week, Stephen, we're told who is going to be appearing. But we will hear from the most senior people within the Department of Health, those people that we saw daily at press gatherings, who told us about social distancing, who told us about how many people should be in our bubbles. And yes, I imagine that when we hear from those people, they will say that we were learning and living with this virus. But one aspect that we've already has already been discussed in London was the fact that there were plans for a pandemic in 2016. We had Operation Cygnus, which allowed every UK nation to start planning for such an event. But we heard earlier last year during the COVID inquiry that those plans were put on hold in order for teams within health and within civil service across the UK to start planning for a no-deal Brexit. So families are angry. They are saying, was the eye taken off the ball within among decision makers because their attentions were turned to other things? So we will hear from those people. The head of the civil service, Jane Brady, currently, she arrived a short while ago. Tomorrow afternoon, we are going to hear from Sir David Stirling, who was at the top of the helm in the civil service, while a lot of those decisions were being discussed around a table. But today, and the families are just gathering outside this hotel, they're holding placards, they're holding posters of loved ones, they're doing interviews. And in their heads and in their minds, they don't feel, they say that they were failed by governments across the UK, and they want to hear answers to why they couldn't get into care homes, why they had to say goodbye to loved ones via Zoom calls. And in their minds, what they have been told so far isn't good enough.
My Louise, thank you very much indeed. And I think very much the role of this programme is to provide a space for many of you who have strong feelings about this, who were affected by this, to pick up the phone to us. 030 30 80 55 55. Dylan, good morning.
Morning.
Tell me how you were affected, Dylan.
Yeah, so back in 2020 in February, I started to get sick. I was showing symptoms of COVID, but because it was so early in the pandemic, the doctors were saying, oh no, it couldn't be COVID, you haven't been travelling. But we know now that I was diagnosed, like, retrospectively, that, yeah, I definitely had COVID. And basically, I never recovered from it. And I was then diagnosed as long COVID because I wasn't getting better. And then after 6 months, Professor Trinick diagnosed me as post-COVID ME.
What are the symptoms?
So for me, the main symptom is post-exertional malaise. So after I exert myself, like, that could be, especially now, it could just be watching TV. That could be a trigger. And then I'll be in severe pain for days, maybe weeks. And it'll be nerve pain all over my body. I'll get migraines. I also have cluster headaches, or suicide headaches, as they're called. I have IBS as well, trigeminal neuralgia, POTS, sleep apnea,
and
caused by COVID.
How do you know it's caused by COVID? How do the authorities know it's caused by COVID rather than another illness coincidentally appearing after COVID?
Well, I had all the symptoms that showed it was COVID, and that would probably suggest it was COVID because I was completely healthy before I got sick. Like, I was going to the gym multiple times a week. I was part of a football team. I was, like, part of orchestra as well.
How old are you, Dylan?
I can't even hold my violin or anything.
How old are you?
I'm 26 now, but I was 22 when I got COVID.
Well, how's this affected your life? I can hear how it's affected it, but...
Yeah. Well, I was supposed to be in Queen's studying medicine, but I had to not take up the offer because I just, like, even if I concentrate for a little bit, that'll trigger my migraines. The nerve pain will start happening. So I spend almost all my time in bed just because of the pain.
My goodness, a 26-year-old spending most of your time in bed.
Yeah, like, the difference now compared to when I was at uni is just light and dark.
This COVID inquiry, it's starting here in the centre of our city, centre of Belfast, in the next few minutes. What answers do you hope to get from that inquiry?
Well, I'm just hoping that they'll raise awareness of long COVID, of ME, and it'll hopefully bring funding. I know in Northern Ireland, there is no specialist service for ME or long COVID. The clinic that I was at for long COVID was terrible. They said to me, "You just don't want to get better." So I immediately withdrew from it. Like, I just thought that was insane. Me, who was supposed to be in medicine at med school, but they're just telling me, "Oh, you just don't want to get better." So, well, I think
many people would find it hard to believe that someone said that to you.
Yeah, well, there's a lot more worse that has happened since I've been diagnosed. The stigma behind post-viral illnesses, like, you wouldn't understand until you've had it and you faced it. Like, I've had doctors say to my face that you're not sick, you're just not trying hard enough. Like, you just don't want to get better. And anyone else with a post-viral illness will have had that experience and they'll know what I'm talking about.
Dylan, thank you very much indeed for talking to us today. I think this brings that call in itself reminds us, if we needed reminded, of how important this inquiry is over the next few weeks, the huge questions which reach into the effect of COVID on people's lives, but also the role of the police here, the questions around how the PSNI policed our streets, our roads, what they required us to do, how they interpreted the law, and that Bobby Storey funeral. The health service, the decisions made around vaccines, this is huge. 03030 80 55 55. Stephen Lisburn. Morning, Steve.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Just a couple of points there to put across. I'm just wondering, who's paying for this inquiry?
Say again, sorry?
Who is paying for this inquiry?
Well, you are. The taxpayer is, of course. Public money.
Right. Okay, so after the inquiry, apparently it's going to take, 3 years before there's a conclusion to it? What happens if someone's found to be unlawful? What does anyone think is going to happen?
Well, it's unlikely that something is going to be found to be unlawful. This is an inquiry to establish learning. To hold people to account for the decisions they made. But remember,
holding them to account, what is going to happen? What's the point in holding them to account?
Well, we were dealing, Steve, also, I think we need to remember this, with a new virus. So
exactly.
To be fair
so
to the
here
people...
We go again. They're just going to say, oh, well, we're learning. So there's it wiped out the window already. What are you going to say to that? You know, they always have an answer. Nothing's going to happen. So, yes, the people that's been affected to it want answers, but unfortunately nothing's going to be done about it.
What answers people do you have, want? Are you talking about lockdown, or what are you talking about?
Everything. Everything about it. I mean, people want answers, but is the answers going to change anything? No.
But what are you concerned about?
I'm concerned about the times that we were locked down when we shouldn't have been. Like the heavy-handedness of the police getting into people's houses and things like that. I mean, there you were running about a forecourt in the garage telling people to wear a mask. You didn't even know what a mask done. And there it's come out now that masks, people wearing masks had no effect whatsoever.
No, it has not come out. That
has
not
come
out.
I've seen it myself. It has not.
Well, I don't know where you read it, but masks absolutely had a role to play in protecting people.
And what about the chief medical officers that you had on? I mean, are they going to be pulled up? I mean, they were telling, they were getting the directions that people were following.
Yes, and that is the role of a chief medical officer. And the chief medical officer was trying, in the absence of a global pandemic for 100 years before COVID-19 came to the world, was trying to make decisions without the benefit of hindsight, Steve.
Yeah, but again, now they're just going to say that's what we thought at the time, and that's why we said.
So, what would you have done differently?
Well, I wouldn't tell people to lock down for a start.
You
wouldn't think that. No, I don't.
And what would the impact have? What would the impact have been on lives?
Well, sure, who knows?
You've looked at any of the data, no?
No, but what I'm saying, you know, somebody shouldn't be told they're not allowed to leave the house,
even if it saves life.
Yeah.
What would
you look
the infection?
After yourself. You have your own self to look after. What, if you want to stay in the house, you stay in the house.
What would the infection rates have been in Northern Ireland if we hadn't the lockdown?
Who knows?
Well, you don't.
Well, neither do you.
And yet you're criticising the people who made the decision to do it.
And you're backing them up.
There were lockdowns across the world. So everybody got it wrong, did they?
No, because they were being told to do it.
Okay.
By the hierarchy. The ones with the money who are not in power. This is a thing. It's all a big scam.
Okay. Steve, thank you for coming to us with your opinion this morning. I think it's going to be a lot of deep discussion in Northern Ireland as this COVID inquiry progresses. Teresa, good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Morning, Teresa. Go ahead.
Hey, Stephen, I just would like to know, what is your obsession with Bobby's story? You've resurrected him more times than our Lord has been.
I don't have an obsession.
Well, you keep
with Bobby's
using
story.
Any excuse to use his name and bring it up.
I think.
And also, you mentioned white text messages.
Yes.
That can't be. Well, was that not the same case in collusion? And yet there's an inquiry going ahead here about COVID.
Well, first of all, in terms of the WhatsApp messages, which were wiped, the inquiry expressed grave concern around them. In terms of the funeral of Bobby Storey, I 100% stand over in the context of a COVID inquiry coming to Northern Ireland when hundreds and hundreds of people throughout Northern Ireland were not able to attend the funerals of the people they love. They weren't even able to get into the care homes.
Yes,
they weren't
I
able to get
that.
Into the hospitals.
Yes.
I absolutely stand over
but
asking...
Also was a
Can I just finish? Because
yes,
you asked me the question.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
I absolutely stand over whether we are going asking the question as to whether we're going to get answers around the policing of that funeral, Belfast City Council's role in that funeral, and Sinn Féin's role in that funeral, given the fact that Michelle O'Neill is now the leader of our country. I think that's called journalism.
Yes, that's good enough. Well, then there was a large funeral at the same time in the Sandy Row. And that never was got the same highlight as what this one has got.
Well, if...
Photographs were in the paper showing
absolutely.
Members of the Orange Order not standing shoulder to shoulder. And yet there was not the same coverage of it.
Were the leaders of the country at it?
I don't know who was at it because I didn't say that. The DUP put out a statement to people to be careful. So I can't say whether they were or not, but they put out a statement at the time.
I think anywhere in a democracy, if you have the leaders of a country giving out rules, giving out requests, guidance for how people should behave, if one of those leaders then has a special circumstance for herself or himself, yes, and all of the rest of us are expected to follow different guidance, I think that would be covered extensively. Teresa, thank you. Yes. Jennifer Gibson. Morning, Jennifer.
Good morning,
Stephen. Good morning. Oh, I can hardly hear you, Jennifer. Can you come closer to the phone for me?
Can you hear me now?
I can. Tell me about your sister.
Well, it was my mother. My mom is Ruth Burke. I am Brenda Doherty's sister.
Okay.
We lost mommy on the 24th, on the 24th of March. She died in hospital because she contracted COVID in hospital. Brenda, my sister, has been on with you a few times. You've spoken to Brenda.
Yeah.
And Brenda is one of the people that have set up the COVID bereavement group, which I am a part of. But unfortunately, I couldn't be at the Clayton today as I'm not well enough. And I just want people to realise the impact of losing a loved one in this manner is absolutely horrific. And for it to be denied, a funeral, a proper funeral, where we know mummy would have had lots of friends and relatives there to lay her to rest, to help us lay her to rest. We were denied all of that. On the Friday after mummy died, we were told that we would only be allowed two people at mummy's funeral. And it wasn't a funeral, it was just a case of laying mum to rest. Now, thankfully, on the Thursday, prior to the funeral, we got an email from Newton Abbey Borough Council to say 10 of us would be allowed. Now, my brothers had already stated to Brenda and I, if there was only two, that Brenda and I had to be there and they would wait outside the cemetery with the grandchildren. But thankfully, and nobody knows how much that meant, just that because 10 of us were allowed to go in, Brenda and I were only allowed close to the graveside. The rest of them had to stand metres away. But it has an impact on us, and it has impacted so much that my sister won't even go to the cemetery now because it was so, so traumatising.
What answers do you want from this inquiry?
Well, I would like to know, you know, we were told we couldn't go in and be with mummy. My mummy died on her own, but with a nurse holding her hand. We couldn't be with mummy. And the thing was, we were always with our mummy. After daddy died, mummy was never alone. But at the end of her days, she died alone, which is something. I know people die on their own, but to be told that you can't be with her is a totally different thing altogether. So I want to know why loved ones had to die on their own and why some people were allowed in and others weren't. And not that I have no problem with people getting in, and I'm so glad that people did get to be with their loved ones. And I would never, ever want anybody to experience what we are all experiencing now. So it's about lessons learned so that this will never, ever happen again.
Part of the lessons learned, Jennifer, may be that the decision, as horrific as it was for you, and you're articulating that today, and your family, maybe those decisions to not allow people to attend their loved ones when they were dying, not to attend funerals, maybe that saved human life. Maybe that curtailed the infection.
Yes, it may have done.
The virus, sorry.
Yes, it may have done. It may have done, and that's something that we'll never know. But just within a matter of weeks, Stephen, of us being told that we couldn't do these things, then certain things were being permitted. Slowly but surely, they were all being brought back again. Maybe a funeral was allowed 20 people at it, maybe a funeral was allowed 30 people at it. But we want that nobody, you know, I suppose they'll never know that the lockdown itself may have stopped the virus spreading rapidly, although it did spread anyhow, it may have spread more. It may have helped, but truthfully, Stephen, I know, I remember my sister saying to me at the time that Robin Swan was actually querying whether or not he would allow people to be with their loved ones when they were dying in the hospital. And Brenda said to me, what do you think? Now, this was about maybe 2-3 weeks after we lost Mummy. I said, well, on hindsight, because all I could think of at this time, all those hours in the home, in our home, all on our own, all I could think about was my mummy was dying on her own. And she was, if she was aware of why we couldn't be with her, and I know, because I know my mummy inside out, my mummy would have been petrified.
Were you allowed to talk to her on the telephone?
No.
No,
not at that point. Not at that point.
Why not?
There was nothing that got being done. That was at the very, very beginning. Mummy was the fourth person in Northern Ireland to die from COVID. And at that point, nothing like that had been implemented. And it was maybe a matter of days and weeks afterwards that we heard more and more of this being implemented. So my mummy hadn't seen any of us. Brenda got up on the Sunday, which was the mother and Sunday, and left some Mother's Day gifts for her. We never know if she got them or if she didn't, because we never got anything belonging to mummy back. Everything was incinerated, bar a gold cross that I had bought her, and I asked for it, and I got it. You know, so mummy did. She died on her own, Stephen. And yet my mummy had company from one of us every single day. And at night, one of us stayed with her after Daddy died. There was very seldom a day went past when mummy didn't have one of us with her. And yet she died on her own.
I can hear the pain. I can hear it.
The pain will never go away. I carry it with me every day. And I can't get up and I can't do things. And I can smile and I can laugh because I know that that's what my mummy would want me to do. But I push myself. I really, really have to push myself every day to do it.
I know.
And I couldn't go today because I'm just, I know I'm not strong enough. Brenda has a strength, and thank God she has, to do what she does. And Brenda and Kieran and Martina, lots of people that are involved with the COVID bereavement group, we thank God for them, because so many of us, this wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for Brenda and Kieran starting off Memory Stones. That's how important this has become to all of us. And we need to be able to be with each other, because it's only those that have lost in this manner know the heartache and the nightmares that you have because of them.
Jennifer, thank you for trusting us with your story today. Thank you. I don't need to sum up what Jennifer has said. She said it very powerfully herself. Mick Fieldy, the editor of Slugger O'Toole, is with us. Good morning, Mick.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And Geraldine. Good morning, Geraldine.
Hi, good morning, Stephen.
You lost your dad to yes. COVID. Mick, I'll come to you in just a moment, Geraldine, if that's all right.
Yes, that's fine.
Mick, I was going to say this is a huge story, and that is nearly gratuitous. This is much more than a story. This is people whose lives and their relationships with their loved ones and their bond with their loved ones was affected by government decisions. Are we going to actually get to the truth? And that might be to the benefit of the decision makers through this inquiry as to how decisions were made.
Well, I certainly hope so, because, you know, this hit everybody out of the blue. You know, and I think some of the early decisions to go to lockdown were a direct result of the crisis in northern Italy, and that the health service there being completely overwhelmed by a wave that seemed to come completely out of the blue. So, and there is no guarantee. I mean, this, there may not be another event like this for 100 years, or it might be in 5 years, or it could be in 15 or 20. We simply don't know. But what's really important is that we learn some of the lessons that are there to be learned. And from your, I mean, I've just listened with the same awe and respect to what Jennifer's just said. But one of your earlier callers talked about post-COVID ME. Now, ME is a Cinderella condition that has been around for a long time. But as you heard in that gentleman's testimony, is still not understood by healthcare specialists. And in some cases, certain clinicians are still treating it as though it was some kind of ghost condition that is to do with the human will and not to do. I think what COVID... So there are issues like that that I think really have to be taken taken seriously. And I would also hope that we recognise that although this is the focus currently is on Northern Ireland, this was a global condition, and that the inquiry will be looking at this whole thing completely in the round, both in the context of the wider UK response, the global response. I would hope some recognition is taken of the Swedish exceptional response to this, which didn't go directly to lockdown but did maintain social distancing. But so, to properly learn the lessons, I think. It will take that length of time to get to that point. But the important thing then is that our systems are responsive. I mean, we had things. I was talking to senior politicians at the time that the crisis hit, and there was a certain degree of frustration that we had to rely on global supply chains for PPE rather than be able to turn and to local manufacturers in Northern Ireland who perhaps had the capability, but the supply chains were simply not there.
There are so many questions around this, aren't there? So many different angles. When you, the PPE story we covered comprehensively, when, Mick, you described ME as a Cinderella condition, what did you mean?
I mean, for a long time, it has not been taken seriously. It should be, and I think we have seen a massive expansion of the condition, previously known as long COVID itself. But you know, the point is that we now have proof that there is a research space there that has to be filled. And you know, this isn't just a case of Northern Ireland working on its own. In terms of the research base, it's international, it's global, and some serious attention now needs to be paid to this condition.
Geraldine, tell me your story.
Yes, good morning, Stephen. Good morning, Mick. Yeah, well, my dad had just recently went into a care home, and the pandemic, the second wave of the pandemic had come along. Unfortunately, he already had Parkinson's, and you know, he wasn't of great strength, but he got sick in the care home and was admitted into hospital for 3 weeks, and probably 2 or 3 days after he got out, he tested positive for COVID. And just, you know, we couldn't, even before that, we had to go to a window, you know, to chat to him through the window with a mobile phone. Because of his Parkinson's, he found it very hard to lift the mobile phone. He was shaking, you know, so he couldn't really hear what we were saying. So the contact, you know, between father and daughter, father and son, was completely lost, you know, at that point. And it was very difficult because we weren't allowed access into sleep.
I can't even begin to imagine what that must have felt like.
Oh, I mean, when you're so close to your dad, he's the model of wisdom and of love and of care and, you know, someone who protects you, you know, all through life. To look at him through a window and not be able to touch him, to tell him that you love him, is very difficult. it'll never be forgotten, you know.
Do you understand why the authorities did it?
I mean, I think the lack of knowledge and the lack of wisdom that really stands out to me is astonishing. You know, as Mick was saying there, you know, they allowed, children to go ahead when they knew and they seen across the water what was happening, you know. Basically, for me, you know, wisdom should have come in to protect their people and say to themselves, we shouldn't let this go ahead. So this just sent through the whole, you know, the whole nation an outburst of COVID and, you know, sent a lot of people to their deathbed. So for me, wisdom very, very much lacked care, empathy, you know, maybe because of a lack of knowledge, I'm not really sure. But to me, yeah, there comes a point when you need to take a stand, whether you're in the government or not, and look to your people. See what's best for your people and not be, you know, I know people get driven by fear and the lack, you know, the right now people will say, okay, masks didn't work, you know, this didn't work, that didn't work. Yes, maybe that comes down to the lack of knowledge because we've never seen this before. But the reality is, think about the person, think about the people, think about the community, think about your land, think about, you know, all these things and what is good and best for them. And I think they made a lot of wrong decisions.
You've never spoken about this before, is that right?
I've never spoken about this. I mean, probably just a family. I mean, but just that this inquiry has come up, you know, I just felt to come on this morning just to express, you know, really what has happened there with us and what we've been left, like Jennifer there, with a massive void, you know. And you know when you, so people when can die all of a sudden, like straight, they can get knocked down, they can, you know, lose their legs straight away like that, and people will always say, I never got to say goodbye.
At the point at which your father then went back into a nursing home and yes, you couldn't be with him, you weren't allowed to be with him, when was the next point you saw him?
Yeah, so we weren't allowed to be in because obviously he had COVID. Now, on a Saturday was when the rules changed in the nursing home. The rules hadn't changed when it came to funerals and things, but the rules had changed. So the manager had let me in that night and my dad died in my arms. I was the only, you know, person there with him. But because of COVID, we lost him. You know, he was out of it. He couldn't breathe. You know, there was no conversation. I mean, I know people, I mean, I talked to him right to the very end till he took his last breath. But, and people say that they can still hear you. And I prayed to God, please let him not die on his own. And I know people haven't had that when their families have died, you know, without them getting that contact. But we never, well, the next time that my mother seen him was outside her door when the funeral directors brought him to the front door in a coffin. And we weren't allowed, we had been told that we weren't allowed him into the chapel. There was only 25 people allowed into the chapel. And that was just awful. You know, that was just awful. So,
Geraldine,
very difficult.
Geraldine, I'm deeply grateful. This is the first time you've spoken about this. I'm deeply grateful that you've come to us. And you know, Mick and I are silent. There's no need. With all due respect, I'm sure, Mick, you'll agree with me this morning. There's very little need for commentators today. What we need to do is hear from people like you and give a voice to people like you, and hopefully it'll resonate around that inquiry. Geraldine, thank you very much.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks, Mick.
It's the guttural pain that's still here today, Mick.
Oh, yeah, you can feel it. And I think one of the things that Geraldine highlighted there is the need for humanity, in the depth of crisis. I mean, when we were going through the terrible times of the Troubles and we were seeing funerals every day and all the rest of it, the one compensation that people had, no matter the circumstances of the passing of their loved ones, was those funerals where comfort was given from the pulpit, was given in the wakes, in the visitation, the tea, cakes, all of those small civilizing parts of our custom. which transcends religion or background or anything else. Yeah. And to have that denied, I think it's wounding.
You talk about religion. Ben and Lauren has contacted us. Ben, you were a minister during COVID.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. I'm a minister in Craigie Hill Presbyterian in Larne. And let me first say, Psalm 34, verse 18, the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. I remember, I still do, I'm looking right now at a folder and a list of those who had to say goodbye to and bury in Craigie Hill Cemetery at that time. And we are on the other side, myself as with ministers and undertakers on the other side of an open grave. And what a time. And our thoughts, my prayers, and that of my colleagues across the community must go out to those who are suffering and who are revisiting this great trauma this morning.
So what you witnessed was many funerals where you were there, an official was there, but the families were locked out.
Oh, Stephen, I remember going through a locked graveyard and we were leading the procession up with myself normally dressed in the undertakers and then meeting staff in full hazmat suits. It was, and I understand why they were there. That was that, and why they were dressed like that. That it was because of council and all the rest. I understand that. That's okay. But for a family, you know, having to pick. Who's going to be able to come in that early time in March? And yes, then revised guidance was given, and so on. And so then we went into the summer. And to be honest, Stephen, I mean, I empathise with what you were mentioning earlier about a very particular public funeral. And I suppose from then on, we very much, I mean, all I could do was sit with families in a living room and say, well, this is what it says, but I want to be able to pay tribute to your loved one, and I want to give as best I can a funeral that will allow you to say goodbye appropriately.
What answers, having witnessed this up close, what would you like to hear answered from this inquiry, Ben?
Good question. I think what I would like to hear would be a sympathy. We want to honour those whom the Lord appoints over. So I understand they didn't have hindsight. They were doing their best. The doctors, the politicians. I mean, what a time that they, and they're just normal humans, were into that cauldron with advice coming from here, from there, us wanting a certain thing and everybody else wanting something else and trying to figure out a way through that and thread a needle, as it were. An answer, I don't know if there's an answer bar an acknowledgement of our grief, our pain, and a looking forward that this might not, that wisdom might be that we would do this differently, or there are things that we can do around nursing homes and so on.
Ben,
and
thank you very much. Better. Thank you very much indeed. The COVID inquiry starts today. We want to be a place where we give you a voice. It's not just inside that inquiry. It's here at the BBC as well. Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. As that COVID inquiry has begun now in Belfast City Centre in the last 3 weeks, can I just absolutely underscore our commitment here at The Nolan Show to be giving you a voice, whatever that voice is, whatever questions you have. It affected every one of our lives in different ways, didn't it? And that also includes, just to be clear, those people who have questions to ask about the vaccine, those people who have questions to ask about the media, those people who have questions to ask about lockdown. I think we need to remember also, in the interests of fairness, that the authorities were handling a new strain that they did not know about before, and they were scrambling, weren't they, to make decisions. But that does not mean that you can't express your view, and we want the Nolan Place to be the place for you to do it. The role of the police, the role of our politicians, the role of the health service, the role of all of us as citizens, 030 30 80 55 55 nolan@bbc.co.uk is our email. At the top of the show today, we heard from the DUP MP Ian Paisley expressing concern about these EU laws, the deal, the negotiation needs sorted, he said, because it is, in his view, would be devastating to the farming industry if veterinary medicines were not allowed to continue to come to Northern Ireland. I say continue to come because there is a grace period that runs out in 18 months' time. Ian Paisley is warning that we need this sorted this summer, not in 18 months' time. The UUP peer, Lord Reg Empey, is with us this morning. Reg, good morning to you.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, as is the Alliance Party MP, Stephen Farry. Let's start with you, Lord Empey. Is there a chance this won't be sorted?
There's a chance it won't be sorted this summer, that's for sure. Because if you look at the political and electoral timetable, we know we're having a UK election, probably could be any time between now and the autumn. We know that there are European parliamentary elections in June. We know that the way Europe works, the Commission, the new Commission, will not be endorsed by the European Parliament until the 31st of October. And therefore, by the time a commissioner gets into position, it could easily be into the new year before meaningful negotiations take place. Now, our anxiety on our committee about all of this is that you can't, the supply chains and the manufacturers are already having to make decisions as to whether or not they will supply the Northern Ireland market, because it is a very small market in international terms, however vitally important it is to us. So, as you will have seen from our committee's response to the government, we are asking them urgently to see if there's any chance of getting a meaningful negotiation going. I think they have been dragging their feet. And of course, Stephen, the most significant part of all of this is there's a complete difference of opinion between the EU and the UK as to what it is the grace period is for. The grace period, according to Europe, is to allow Northern Ireland to get itself aligned entirely with EU rules, whereas the UK government are still talking about hoping to have a negotiation. And the very fact that there's no agreement on what the grace period is for causes our committee very great concern.
So why don't we, and there will be many different political views on this, but if we aligned with EU rules with regards to the medicine, would that solve it?
It could create another problem, because we also have to make sure we align with UK rules and Great Britain rules, because at the end of the day, our principal market is supplying food to Great Britain. I mean, 18% of the cattle in Northern Ireland has 18% of the cattle in the UK, 15% of free-range eggs, organic eggs in Great Britain come from Northern Ireland. We're feeding up to 10 million people. I mean, that's our principal market. But the problem we have is, under the current rules, the way things are changing, Northern Ireland is being treated as part of the single market by the European Union, and therefore we are expected to agree to their rules. On the other hand, we must ensure that the rules we adhere to in Great Britain do not prevent our product from being marketed there, which is our biggest market.
And those are the circumstances that your party consented to by going back into Stormont. You didn't want to stay out and continue to fight these type of things. Your party said, get back in. The DUP went back in, and nobody got this sorted before they went back in.
Well, first of all, Stephen, if we go back there, I mean, you've got to remember our party recommended that people do not follow the DUP's line and leave the European Union under these circumstances, because we knew that it was a disaster. We knew that things weren't ready. I have no issue with leaving the European Union if we did it properly. But the problem we were faced with was in 2019, Boris Johnson proposed the border in the Irish Sea to the European Union, and the DUP endorsed it at that stage. And we haven't recovered from that. So that argument, I think, needs to be put to bed. What we've got to do now is concentrate on finding solutions. And I believe there are solutions. And one of them could very well be, as we propose, grandfathering rights. In other words, medicines that were supplied to Northern Ireland prior to our departure from the European Union should be recognised as continuing so that they don't have to have any further checks. But there are one or two key critical points, Stephen. I don't think it's been mentioned yet. Because of the configuration of farming in Northern Ireland, the fact that we've a large amount of poultry industry cheek by jowl with grazing animals, when the chicken litter is spread on the fields, grazing animals have the risk of picking up botulism, and there is no cure for that. So we currently have the animals are vaccinated to prevent this, and under the current proposals, that vaccine would not be available under EU rules unless we have a specific agreement to allow it to come in. So these are the sort of things, practicalities, that we have to address.
Stephen Farry?
Well, I think Stephen's first thing is then to welcome the report from the House of Lords Committee, and obviously this is an absolutely crucial issue for our agri-food sector. All this, of course, goes back to Brexit, which was the original sin in this regard. And while we have the Windsor framework and the new additions to that, we are trying to square an impossible circle. And there will always be these issues that come up that are incredibly thorny. And the issue of veterinary medicines flows as one of those. Now, we have the template of what was agreed in the Windsor framework in relation to the movement of human medicines, which can provide a lot.
Why wasn't this in it?
Well, I think the issue of veterinary medicines, while there are some similarities, is a more complex order, Stephen, because obviously with human medicines, that's the end point, but whereas with veterinary medicines, often you're talking about what goes into the food chain, and the issue then is where the food chain needs to. And as Lord MP was saying, obviously the UK market is incredibly important to agri-food in Northern Ireland.
So what are we going to do
on the island?
We're not going to leave this to the last minute, are we?
Well, the pressure is on. I mean, the work group has been put in place by the UK government. My colleague, the Agriculture Minister, Andrew Muir, is part of that. So we are at the coalface looking for a solution in this regard. And the medicines model may provide some degree of a template. I think, I mean, you hit on it earlier on, Stephen, the more that the UK and the European Union are aligned on these issues, the easier these things will be. And so the risk of divergence is probably part of the problem and concern here. And I mean, hopefully under the incoming Labour government, we will see moves towards a comprehensive SPS veterinary agreement with the European Union, which will provide a wider context.
But this is so crucial to our food supply, to our economy, to the farming industry, therefore jobs and their livelihoods. Is there a momentum? Is there a genuine urgency within political parties, including your own, to get this sorted?
There is, Stephen. When we have that working group, we've all been flagging it. I mean, we've met as a party with the various veterinary groups, and NOAA is the main that represent the body in that regard. And I believe there are various models out there and that are being examined as such. The committee has highlighted some of those in its report. A lot of this will depend upon trust as well with the European Union, and this goes into the wider picture in terms of good relations being built and lack of default in terms of other agreements. Because if the European Union trusts that the systems that can be put in place that are particular to the island of Ireland, particular to Northern Ireland, are not going to lead to a wider risk to the single market, then progress can be made. But if people start playing games on other issues, that will set us back. So it's important that we see this as part of a wider whole picture in terms of better relationships with Europe.
And Stephen, just a couple of questions about other matters. You talk about trust with the European Union and building relationships. Do you think the Irish government, part of the European Union, is right to want the UK to take migrants back who cross into the EU from Northern Ireland?
Well, I think, Stephen, we need to see countries working together, not just in terms of Ireland and the UK, but right across the European Union in terms of what is a global migration reality.
But that's a, that's an answer that doesn't really mean anything, given the particular issue that we have. Is the Irish government right in saying to the UK, take those migrants back, or is Rishi Sunak right saying no?
Well, I think both governments at the moment have engaged in slightly dangerous rhetoric around this. First of all, I think the Rwanda bill is an absolutely horrible piece of legislation, and we're seeing now the first steps towards implementation, and quite a few sort of very unhelpful comments being made by the Prime Minister. The second thing to say is I am very sceptical about this figure of 80% of new asylum applicants in the Republic of Ireland coming via Northern Ireland. I don't think those figures stack up. Certainly the NGOs and that work in Northern Ireland don't recognise that type of figure.
Are you concerned about the number of migrants who may wish to come to Northern Ireland and stay here, rather than going to the Republic of Ireland, or is there no need for concern?
What I think, Stephen, we need to see is all parts of these islands playing a proportionate part in managing the situation in terms of migration, and avoid a situation where we're playing bigger than thy neighbour, where one region tries to shift what is perceived as a problem onto someone else.
You've answered my question quite skillfully, avoiding what I'd ask you, which is, do you support the Irish government requesting that migrants, that the UK takes migrants back who travel from this part of the UK, Northern Ireland, into the Republic illegally?
The answer, Stephen, is no, but let me put it in a different way, which I think is the important emphasis here. Everyone is framing this issue of migration as a problem. Something has been dumped upon societies. Now, there is issues in terms of resources right across the board, and we need to be investing in those for everybody, rather than having a situation where we're playing off the interests of migrant refugees against other people. We have to see migration, Stephen, as something that actually adds enrichment to our society. Okay. Most people who are migrants are of economic age. They can make a contribution to our economy. We know there's massive skill shortages in many aspects of our economy.
And with enough housing? With enough housing stock,
this is an issue, and you can talk about the budget with me at length at another time. But we do need to see investment across the board for everyone in our society, and I mean that's an issue in the south. It's an issue in Northern Ireland. It's an issue in Great
Britain. Do we have enough housing at the moment?
But we need to be doing more in housing. Okay. We need to be doing more in health, more in education, everyone, Steve. But the point is, migrants will actually be net contributors to our economy in terms of the taxes they pay in. So from it, we actually will obtain greater wealth that we can reinvest for everyone. So we need to change the tone of this discussion in a more inclusive way.
Two other stories, very briefly, while I have you on. I was reading the newsletter the other day, and I saw the headline, Alliance blocks 365-day flying of Union flag on war memorials, as unionist critics call the party anti-democratic. What's wrong with flying a flag on a war memorial?
Stephen, there's nothing wrong with flying a flag on a war memorial in a respectful way, particularly around the various remembrance events that take place. What we don't want to see is a situation where unionist parties, I think largely for electoral reasons, are trying to stir up a situation and politicise something that should be all-inclusive for the community.
Do you have a problem with the 365-day flying of a union flag on a war memorial?
Well, Stephen, these proposals came from unionist politicians in Ards and North Down Council, and indeed even the Green Party abstained on the issue rather than actually standing up for inclusion. The Royal British Legion has not been pushing for this to happen. This is entirely a political stunt that's been driven by certain unionist parties.
But for those people who want to know your view on whether, as a point of principle, you have a problem with all year round flying of a union flag on a war memorial, do you?
Stephen, we have to recognise that this is Northern Ireland, and flags need to be handled in a very sensitive and inclusive way. There is a time and a place for the flying of the Union flag
on a war memorial,
whether it's in public buildings or on war memorials. And it's important that we don't end up criticising this. I'm currently speaking to you from London. In Great Britain, we don't see a situation where people criticise war memorials. They're part of our shared...
Is it criticising? Inclusive. If someone wants the flag of what they see as their country on a war memorial, people who fought for the freedom that you now have to speak.
Well, Stephen, we have survived for the best part of a century respecting war memorials without people trying to politicize them. And all of a sudden today, people decide they want to change.
How many days would be acceptable to the Alliance Party?
Well, we're talking, I mean, there's no magic formula here, but we're talking about doing this around what are the set commemorations, which would be in particular, given the particular contribution of Northern Ireland around the Somme commemoration in early July, and also around the remembrance time in November.
And Stephen, finally, the COVID inquiry, obviously, for those people passing the Clayton Hotel today, for those people listening to the media, the COVID inquiry beginning today. And we've heard a lot of grief on this programme today from people who are questioning some of the decisions that were made. People made decisions without the benefit of hindsight, which the inquiry now has. Have you any questions for the inquiry?
Well, Stephen, I mean, you've obviously had a lot of people who are expressing very harrowing experiences from COVID, and obviously this period is going to be difficult in terms that will may well reemerge for a lot of people, and others are living with it every day. And I've met with some of the COVID bereaved families, so I understand the pain. Look, it is absolutely right that we learn lessons in terms of not just the UK government, but also the devolved regions in terms of how COVID was handled. It was an unprecedented situation. I think most of the decisions that were taken were correct and will stand up under scrutiny. There may well be others several years on that people will rightly question, but that is the natural part of learning lessons. See, and I mean, I can speak for my own colleague, Naomi Long, as a minister who followed the advice that was given from the professionals, and that's the best thing the ministers could have done at the time.
Okay. Stephen, thanks for taking questions on that whole range of subjects. Thank you very much indeed. Conor Evan Hall died on the 25th of August 2021 after he caught COVID. George Little, age 80, died on the 16th of December 2020. His wife Violet died a month later, 17th of January 2022, after contracting COVID. Conor's mum, Breesh, and George and Violet's daughter, Hazel, are at the COVID inquiry this morning. They spoke to Brendan, our reporter, earlier.
And this is my son, Connor. Connor contracted COVID in August 2021. He was 23 years of age. Connor, first of all, was very sick. At the start, he thought he had just food poisoning because he had been out with his friends, thought he got a dodgy pizza. But it turns out on day four that Connor had actually got COVID. But Connor's got worse over the next couple of days, and it was just phone calls back and forward to the doctor explaining how Connor was feeling and that. But on day seven, Connor lost his life. He just stopped breathing. But I was lucky that I had him at home, whereas there's lots of people here didn't get to see their loved ones. They didn't get to talk to them, you know. So I do feel slightly grateful that I was with Connor when he passed away. But Connor was one of four boys. Look, we all just miss him so, so much. Deep down, I think Connor should have been taken to the hospital. He should have been treated. I think he was neglected big time. Is that okay?
And you're holding a picture of Connor.
Yeah.
Obviously, what do you want? What are you expecting from today?
From today, just don't want anybody come through what we have went through as a family. And whatever changes happened here today, we hope nobody will ever have to go through this.
You're holding a picture. Is this your dad, is it?
It's my dad and my mum.
Your dad and your mum, and they both?
I lost both of them.
Okay. What are you expecting from today?
I want to find out why things weren't done that should have been done 9 months into the pandemic. My dad took not well in December 2020, went off to hospital, and that was the last time I saw him again, apart from saying goodbye on an iPad. My mum fought so hard in hospital. She was not given the medical treatment I believe she should have been getting. and I think somebody needs to be held accountable, and we need this inquiry to make sure that the lessons are learned, legislation is actually implemented, and that we do not have to go through this, or any other family doesn't have to go through this in the future.
Today is obviously going to be hard. It's going to bring back memories.
It's very emotional. I am here today because I need to be here. They cannot have died in vain. They were a very, very quiet couple, devoted to each other, and I'm an only child, and this is all I can do for them.
And you're doing this for your mum and dad.
Yeah, and everybody else in the country. Nobody deserves to have their parents disappear a month and a day apart.
A month and a day apart.
Yeah.
So you lost everything.
I lost everything within a month and a day, and I still can't accept it. I still can't accept that they're gone. I haven't been able to clear their house out totally. Nothing is sort of sinking in that they are definitely gone. I keep thinking they've been in the hospital, they're hidden. Someday they might be found. That's the reality of the way my mind thinks at times of this can't have happened.
But, my goodness, what a profound statement. Nobody deserves to have their parents disappear. Brendan Marshall down at the Clayton Hotel reporting for us. Philip, morning to you, Philip.
Morning, Stephen. Oh, it's so sad, these stories, Stephen. You know, I lost my mum in January 2023, but at the start of the pandemic, my mum contracted COVID before the vaccines. So that took its toll on my mum, and she ended up in Antrim ICU. You know, couldn't get up to visit her or anything. You know, it was horrific. And she had COPD, which is something that only gets worse in time. You know, so.
So when your mother was in intensive care, you weren't allowed in?
No, I went up this year at Antrim Hospital. I even had stuff. In my mind, I was bringing her up stuff, you know, to bring to her. But, I mean, got the stuff to her through the doctor or something. Like, I kind of don't know. It was a wee bit of a dream state or something like that there, Stephen, you know what I mean, whenever that happens. But I passed, like, young people and stuff like that, and they were crying, and so there was obviously someone else there. It was,
and obviously, the very definition of intensive care, people on the brink of losing their lives, had COVID, had got inside that ICU ward, it would have been devastating. So you can see the logic behind what the authorities were doing.
Stephen, see the way with technology is today, AI and everything, you think this year could have been like seen, like mapped or whatever ahead of time. And God willing, other generations will never have to go through this. You know what I mean? Because it was a horrific time. A lot of people lost a lot of people. People were fear death. You know what I mean? People with mental illness, OCD, various mental illnesses, and death, you know what I mean, and routine. It was horrific, Stephen. It's massive. It was a massive thing, you know.
Yeah, I'm hearing on my program today how the pain, how the search for answers is still very, very raw, even now, all this time later.
That's crazy, Stephen. I just wish I had something in place to see this coming, and God willing, for the sake of future generations, they'll have something mapped out. Like, the way technology is today, there's great advancements, you know. So,
well, let's see what comes out of it. Philip, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Stephen. Thank you
for talking to us today. Thank you to all of you who trusted us with your stories today. I know it's been, we could all hear the pain in your voices, and we here at the BBC, we will continue to report on that inquiry and the questions and the answers emanating from it, and we continue to provide you with a space if you want to contact me, nolan@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for your company today. We'll see you all tomorrow, 9 o'clock. See you then. Have a good day.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.
schon mal eine Ferienunterkunft gebucht, die der reinste Horror war?
Das sieht gar nicht aus wie auf den Fotos.
Komm, der Eingang ist hinten rum.
Was zum...
Ist da eine Tür hinter all den Spinnen?
Dann probier eine App, mit der ein Happy End gewiss ist.
Ah, guck mal, keine einzige Spinne in Sicht.
Wo wollen wir die nächsten 8 Stunden als erstes entspannen?
Alles gut, du hast bei Fevo direkt gebucht.